Okay, so welcome to the second half of your first class on Britain since the Romans, and this class is entitled Invasions. Everybody likes invasions like Dune and things like that. Now, let's have a little picture of England at the time. Now, I need to close that one and open that one, and we'll be away. Whee. Okay. Japohama. A partir du début. Right, okay. England, what was England like at this time, yeah, when you walked along? Well, the first thing to remember is that there are enormous number of forests and marshes. Yeah, a lot of the land has not been used. It's not forests which are nice places to walk around, but more forests which make it impossible for you to grow anything or to keep animals. Yeah, because people were not romantic about the countryside before the 19th century. It was just an annoying place to be. And even today, I find the countryside is dirty and there's no Wi-Fi, so you know, I'm not really interested in the countryside. Now, urban life had begun to decline even before the Romans left at around 410. For example, Roman roads were often left unrepaired. Industry, a very basic industry we're talking about, was not so well developed. When the early Christians built churches, very often they had to get experts from Italy or from Germany to build their churches because the skills were no longer available. Now, over the next 200 years, from the late 5th century, let's get this right, 5th century, 400, 480, late 5th century, let's go quickly, the Angles, the Saxons and the Jutes, three German tribes, began the colonization from the east coast. They expelled the native Britons, pushing them back into Scotland and Wales, and they set up villages all over England with names which often ended in ton, Accrington, Worthington, Preston, many of them. Names which ended in ham, Birmingham. Names which ended in ing, Worthing. Place names are very, very useful for historians because people do not like to change the name of their town. They really do not like to change the name of their town. And so they last century after century. This is a moment for me to do my little campaign. France is the only place in the world where people talk about les pays anglo-saxons, pour parler de l'Australie, l'Amérique et l'Angleterre, c'est une travestie totale. C'est l'identité française, voire la fierté française qui veut une unité ailleurs pour dire on n'est pas comme eux. When I went to America, I felt more abroad than in Poland. There really isn't. Nobody in Britain ever says Anglo-Saxon countries like Britain and America. It's a completely Franco-French idea. Now, I don't want to be too mean. The English have very stupid ideas about France, so you know, it's just. I'm not trying to be nationalistic. Now, there is some debate. Now, the story I just told you. The Anglo-Saxon Jutes came in and pushed the massacred. How did they push them out? By killing half of them and the other half ran away. This is the story which has been told for a long time, and it's still the story I think is correct. However, there is a debate now. Recently, some historians have suggested that there was not such a violent invasion. And one of the reasons they use is that there are some places where they can show that continuous settlement over several centuries, from the 4th to the 10th century, and no sign of, you know, the village being burned to the ground or anything like that. So these new historians say the situation is not like what happened in Australia or the United States, where the native peoples were, well, massacred and pushed out. But in fact, according to these new historians, quite a small number of Anglo-Saxons established themselves, and over time merged their culture with the ones of the existing English. So this is good. Historians argue. The reason I prefer the old story is again about place names. The Romano-Celts, the people who were there before they arrived, the Romano-Celts. They're Celtic, but they're very much influenced by Roman. There are approximately zero villages or towns in England with Celtic names. And I consider that to be a very, very strong suggestion that and there are millions of places with Anglo-Saxon names or Jute names. And for me, that's a very strong argument that they pushed them out and gave another name to the village. Because you can't give another name to the village by being influential. You really have to. Another piece of evidence of this says, if you look for names of streams, woods, natural features, there are many Celtic names in England. So this sounds to me like the Anglo-Saxons arrive quite violently, take over, rename the towns, but are happy to use traditional names for the hill or the stream because it's not politically important. But the most important thing about this, because obviously you can't really judge, is that even on such a basic fact, historians can argue with each other. Historians like to argue. The new settlements. So they didn't just take over old settlements, there were also new settlements with Saxon names, especially then Tun and Ham, Chatham, or ones with Stow, How Stow, Bury, Canterbury, Bourne, Eastbourne, other just very, very large numbers of them, and there you can see Birmingham. The airport was built later. Now the Anglo-Saxons used a very different strategy from the Romans. The Romans arrived, gave privileges to the elite and tried to integrate the elite into the Roman elite. This was not the case of the Saxons. The general method of the Saxons was much more violent. Kill all the young men, make everybody else slaves. Yeah, sounds good. I could do that. And indeed, the Anglo-Saxon name for Britain, for a person from Britain, came to mean slave. How do we know what happened to the Britons? Well, one of the things that we know is that if you take the English language today, absolutely tiny number of Celtic words in it, whereas a very, very large number of Saxon words. In fact, the Saxon words in English are all these wonderful one-syllable words. Shoes, hat. This means that if you're English, you can raise your children monosyllabically. Yeah, in the morning, say, eat, wash, hair, shoes, coat, out. You can't do this in French. Yeah? I brought up my daughter in monosyllables. It was a wonderful experience. Poor child. So most of the Britons fled or were massacred, and the Celtic languages moved north to Scotland, far west to Cornwall. There is a Celtic language in Cornwall, which actually disappeared in the 19th century. The last speaker died, but has been revived recently. So the Celtic languages, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, Cornish, and Manx, the Isle of Man. It's actually a Celtic language in the Isle of Man. And these languages have had more or less success in surviving since. By the early 7th century, the Saxons had set up kingdoms of their own. We still don't have England. We have the Heptarchy. Now, if you remember your Greek, Heptarchy has how many kingdoms with a Heptarchy? Yeah. Pentarchy? Tetrarchy? How many for a Pentarchy? How many sides does the Pentagon have? No, not the Pentagon, a Heptagon. Seven. There's the seven kingdoms. The Heptarchy is the seven kingdoms. Kent, Sussex, Essex, East Anglia, Wessex, Mercia, and Northumbria. And you will notice that all of, well, you might not notice, but all of these except one is still used today as a name, but not as a kingdom, simply as a county. So what happened when the Anglo-Saxons came along? Was there resistance? Well, we don't know, really. We don't know if there was much resistance. We don't have much evidence. And in fact, the archaeological evidence of the invasions is very, very weak. Like I said, the place name evidence is pretty good. But we do have stories, and this introduces the question of what can you do with a story. And famous myth, this is King who? Look at the furniture. La table ronde. We say Arthur, King Arthur, the only king in history to be famous for his furniture. And so it may be that the stories of King Arthur and his knights are based on the last resistance of the Romano Celts against the Anglo-Saxons. The details of Arthur's story are mainly composed of folklore and literary invention, but there can be, there might be some historical base. Certainly they have elements of Celtic culture, the magic sword, Excalibur. Anyway, in 449, the Jutish kingdom of Kent was founded. In 547, the kingdom of Northumberland was founded, and by the 8th century, or 700 et quelques, by the 8th century, people began to say Angles to talk about all of these people, Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. Les pauvres Jutes, tout le monde les a oubliés, hein, les Anglo-Saxons, les Jutes alors. C'est l'expression, Jutes alors. Okay, that was a bad one, wasn't it? Yeah. Religion. Now, of course, the Anglo-Saxons brought their religions with them. Christianity was already present in Britain because of Constantine and the Roman Empire. In Germany, the Saxons worshipped a few gods and goddesses, and especially the goddess Nerthus. Now, it is generally accepted by anthropologists that old civilizations which have goddesses as well as gods, that this is a symbol for how much place women had in the society. That societies which had more power for women had goddesses as well as gods. Now, it sounds, I'm not an expert, but it sounds to have a certain logic. And that although monotheism and Christianity had great political advantages, it had a disadvantage for women because it was a huge symbol that the person who really counts is a man. Now, we don't know a lot about the religious rituals in Britain before Christianity, but we know that they had magic runes. This is magic writing. Si vous êtes des fans du Seigneur des Anneaux, vous y connaissez quelque chose. Holy trees, amulets. This is the thing, jewelry which you carry to protect yourself. And priest taboos. Now, what's a priest taboo? That is, if you're a priest, there's some things you're not allowed to do. This is still the case today. If you're a Catholic priest, you cannot marry. Why? This is a taboo. It's a priest taboo. Although the word taboo we didn't have at the time. The word taboo was brought back in the 18th century by Captain Cook. The Anglo-Saxons buried rich people with their riches. In a similar way that the ancient Egyptians did, the idea is that the riches will be useful to you after your death. Now, the worship of the Anglo-Saxon gods continued for some time. Even in the 8th century, the Christian church had to work very hard to stop people from worshipping on Thursday the Anglo-Saxon god Thunor. But Christianity rose, and the kings, the Anglo-Saxon kings, eventually converted to Christianity because they saw the usefulness of joining a religion which had an international network. In 601, Pope Gregory told the missionaries to England to convert pagan temples into Christian churches. So, Christianity came to Britain twice. once with the Romans, and then the Anglo-Saxons invaded and had pagan tradition again, and then again from the 7th century, so from the late 6th century, Christianity came back. First of all, Saint Augustine came back. Saint Augustine was from North Africa, which is always a good thing to remind the racists. He was sent by Pope Gregory the Great to evangelize the island, but we do know that there were some Christians already available in Britain. Excuse me, just a moment. This is one of the problems of the mask. The Christian in 597, Christianity was formally adopted as an official religion by King Ethelbert, and a monastery was founded at which town? You will not be surprised, Canterbury. And even today, the Archbishop of Canterbury is the top dog. That's not very respectful, is it? It's the most important person in the Church of England, except for the Queen. Nevertheless, the Christian religion spread on a much firmer basis in Ireland, with St. Patrick, and St. Patrick helped to evangelize Ireland in 430 AD. He was born in Roman Britain when he was about 16. He was captured and carried off as a slave to Ireland and worked on a farm and became very Christian. And he said that when he was in his 20s, he heard a voice telling him that he would soon go home. And he had a vision saying that he must convert Ireland to Christianity. After 50 years after the official re-establishment of Christianity, the kings began to order the destruction of pagan idols, of the pagan statues. First of all, Kent, and then slowly the rest. There was some pagan resistance. But the Christianity won. J'avais pas une église. It says slide Saxon church. No slide, no Saxon church. In 878, the Danish king of East Anglia was baptized. Now, of course, the Christian history says, oh yeah, but well, the missionary came along and impressed the king with the power of God, and so he became a Christian. It's a bit more political than that. It was like, would you like to join our church? We have people all across the world, and we can all read and write. It's a good argument. It was a good argument there. So let's move on to the next invasion. More invasions. The Vikings. We have lots of invasions until 1066, and then we don't have any anymore. So the Viking invasions from 800 to 1066. Now, the Vikings were really good at traveling. They went to North America. They went to South Africa, the Vikings, and there was a fabulous exhibition in the British Museum in London a couple of years ago. Now, the Vikings originally simply attacked and took all the gold and ran away. Yeah, for 100 years, that's what they did. They just raided. They first raided the country in 787. Vikings from Norway settled in the north and west of the Scottish mainland and in the Scottish islands. And the great army of Vikings from Denmark landed and settled in the east of England. So there you have the Viking invasions. The stories of the Vikings is full of myths. Yeah, a lot of the things we see in fiction on the Vikings are not really true. I remember they recently found the body of a Viking warrior with many years ago, and they just did DNA on it and found out that it was a woman warrior, in fact. Yeah, because there's all sorts of things that we assume about the past which are just not true. What did the Vikings have an advantage? Well, if you're going to, more advice for your future profession, if you're going to raid, you need to be able to move quickly. And if you have a sail and the rowers, you're really just far superior to any other kind of ship for attacking and running away very quickly. This is not a real Viking ship. This is a real Viking ship. This is from the Viking Museum, I think it's in Norway, which I was lucky enough to go to. And because there was an enormous muddy part of the river outlet, it was buried in mud for more than 1,000 years. And mud is wonderful because it preserves it. So it's actually a real one, which I think is absolutely amazing to have a real Viking ship. If you're in, I think it's in Oslo, the Viking Museum. There it is. That was really cool. This is in the same museum. This is one of the carts they used, just to show. Really, this is probably a ceremonial cart because it's very intricately designed. So it may have been for funerals or things like that. And I use it to show because we sometimes have this image of Vikings who just chop your head off and eat your animals, but they also could do things like this. Now, one of the things that the Vikings did is that they founded and renamed the city of York. And in York, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, they decided to open a museum of everyday Viking life in York. It's called Jorvik. And so this is a reproduction of what we know about everyday life at the time. It's a Jorvik, J-O-R-V-I-C, that you have to see if you go to York. Oh, I just did that. Okay. We get that one twice. Okay. Oh no, that's another one. There's another one. So, meanwhile, in England, in 829, Egbert becomes the first ruler of all England. Remember, we have these seven kingdoms. The number of kingdoms reduces, and you have all England from 829. Après, il y a un petit moment où ce n'est plus all England, mais puis c'est à nouveau all England. And Alfred the Great, later on in the 9th century, what did he do? He's very symbolic. Bizarrely enough, the story that everybody hears about him when he was a child is that he let some cakes burn. I don't know why this is important, but anyway, that's what we... Alfred the Great and the burning of the cakes. But what he did, which was even more important, was that he reformed, he codified Saxon law. He said, we're having the same law everywhere in England, and it's going to be written down. Now, this is tremendously important. Written law is an important moment in the development of the state. Previously, it's what the king wants this week is law, and what the king wants next week, if it's different, is also law. So Alfred the Great reformed and codified Saxon law, promoted a revival in learning, schools and monasteries, and most importantly, asked for the writing of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is a history book that Alfred told people to write. Now, as you understand, at the even today, but especially at the time, you didn't have to be very objective or very truthful. Your history book would show how wonderful the English were from the beginning to the end. But nevertheless, there's still a lot of information in there, and we historians are tremendously grateful to Alfred for the... there you go. So Alfred the Great defeated the Vikings, and Britain was divided into two parts. Now, what's important here is the Dane law is still under Viking control, and underneath you have the kingdom of Alfred, and very slowly the Vikings will be pushed out. Now, the English who were fighting the Vikings, they had a lot of different tactics. Sometimes they simply paid the Vikings, please don't invade, here's some money. Yeah? This is called the Danegelt. And sometimes they said, okay, you can control that part of England, that's the Dane law, but very gradually this will come back. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, there are 9 surviving manuscripts and fragments which are in the British Library in London, in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and in Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, the ones that you can see. Alfred the Great and and the following kings slowly pushed the Vikings out. by 918. And really, England began with Athelstan, who was crowned King of all Britain in 925. And he was sufficiently organized that we still have his tomb and we know where it is, and so on and so forth. And so here we are in Anglo-Saxon classic society after the Vikings. So what did this society look like? Well, very often loyalty was at the center of society, loyalty to one's lord. And loyalty was personal and not tribal. A servant would have a duty to vengeance if the lord was killed, and would take an oath of allegiance to the lord. This was the Anglo-Saxon way of doing things. So the Christian church adapted itself to the situation. So, for example, if somebody killed your lord and then you killed the person, even though in theory in Christianity that's a really big deal, in fact the priest would say, well, you know, say a few prayers and it's okay, you know, because they were obliged to adapt to the local situation. And it was very common to have blood feuds. Now, blood feuds is not good. It means, you know, you killed my brother, so I have to kill your two sisters. Yeah, it's no fun. Yeah, sorry about that. I hope you don't have nice sisters. Okay. Now, the structure of society, you have the king and his court at the top. This did not exist in Germany, in Saxon Germany. But the king becomes more and more important. And indeed, there are many things we don't know, but an amazing archaeological discovery in 1939... qui est le sujet d'un film tout récent qui s'appelle The Dig, qui est assez sympa. They discover the ship burial and they found stuff like that. Now this is an amazing piece to find, and they also found this stuff. Now this is obviously from a burial of somebody who was very rich, perhaps a king, and you find it in the British Museum in London, which is free. Well, you have to get to London, but yeah, it's free otherwise. The king moved around his kingdom. He had to move around because he couldn't stay where he was, because you have to always make sure, who's my friend, who's my enemy? Oh, he's not sure. Let's give him a present. It's very much about personal loyalty and keeping it. It's worse than being president of the French Republic. Religion was extremely important. Half of King Alfred's income was spent on religion. However, being an Anglo-Saxon king was rather harder work than being the Queen of England today. The Saxon king would have to lead the army into battle. Noblemen and noble women could hold big estates. So under the king, the aristocracy, the noblemen and women could hold big estates, 15 or 20 or 30 big farms. But all the building was in wood, so it's disappeared. But notice I said noble men and noble women. 300 years later, women will not have the right to own land. This is important because we quite often get the impression that the rights of women have been a gradual and automatic rise. This is not true. In the elite, it was much better to be a woman aristocrat of the 8th century than of the 14th century. And even later, even in the population in general, women had more space in public in the 17th century than in the 19th century. So it's not automatic progress doesn't exist. Spoiler. The only famous Anglo-Saxon noble woman is Lady Godiva, and this is a statue of her. And apparently, what happened in 1050. Lady Godiva was in sympathy with the people of Coventry who were taxed too much, and she appealed to her husband to reduce the taxes. And he said, "Oh well, I'll reduce the taxes if you ride through the street without your clothes on." And so she did that. Now, I don't know if this is true, but it's a great story. The kings became more important, land became more important, and so on. And that is the hierarchy: king at the top, noblemen and noble women. Sorry, Ian Futafapa, noble women, churls, and then slaves. Churls are ordinary free farmers. Churls were relatively free; they could leave town if they wanted to. but they often lived in poor houses. Now, I know that, yeah, I hope that you live in a better house than this one, but the worst, what is the worst thing about this house? What is the thing you really wouldn't like? I can't hear you. Oh, the grass. More than that. Yeah? I can't hear you, I'm sorry. Oh, it's easy to burn, yes. Especially because you have a fire there every day. But I was thinking of something. There's no chimney. There's no hole in the roof to let the smoke out. So you just lift in smoke, you know, which is no fun. Money was not so important. Most social relations were by duties. This shepherd has the right to use this field, provided that they also help the king with his sheep. This monastery has the right to have all these fields if they repair the bridge every year. So a tremendously complex set of rules, feudal rules. It is the next period, it's more from the 11th to the 14th century, the rise of money. Now, we're often very critical of money, but it's easier. You sometimes see this in modern life. You know, when you have a situation with, if you do the Resto du Coeur or something like that, and you collect food from the supermarkets to give to people who need it, it's easier to collect money and buy what they need. It really is. I think it's a very, very good thing, but it's true that you find yourself with an enormous amount of, you know, cassoulet, and you say, oh, you know, well, do you eat pork? No. Oh, do you eat pork? Money is just the simplest way of doing things. So that's to say, that's the same thing for feudalism. There they are. They look very happy, don't they? These are not real ones, yeah? These are pretend ones. One of the things, if you look at the field system, in fact, from the air, very often you can see the field system from 1,000 years ago. Now, at this time, they had an open field system, and the open field system simply means that if you own one acre of land, in fact, you own one strip there, one strip there, and one strip there. So, say you have, let's make a simple example. The village has three big fields. And each of you, you're not, the slaves are over there, okay, each of you has one strip in each field. And the reason for that is that you have one crop here, a second crop here, and nothing here. It needs to rest. Yeah? And then you move them around. And so you have to have a strip everywhere. But from the point of view of technology, it's pretty inefficient. Certainly it doesn't encourage you to improve your strips. Because that's the thing. Now, the lots of entertainment, minstrels, buffoons, acrobats, bull baiting is you get a bull and then you try to make it angry, you know, with a burning stick. Have you never done this? You haven't lived. Okay, cockfighting. Again, these are things which we find quite shocking, and I think it's connected with the fact that there was so much violence in their lives that it wasn't shocking. Because remember, of course, that watching people die was very common because people didn't live very long. Famine was not unusual. Probably most of the adults were in quite. They studied a cemetery recently from this time, from the 8th century, and they found and they analysed the bones, and they found that people were quite fit and certainly not fat. However, they didn't wash. They didn't know about washing. In fact, the king had a bath every month. That wouldn't be not much fun. And lots of things were very ill-disciplined. For example, they had great problems stopping people from getting drunk in the church on Sundays. Things like that. The slaves were... Now, you weren't always a slave for life. You could become a slave because you lost a battle. You could become a slave if your parents were very poor and had nothing to eat. They could sell you into slavery. And slaves would be stoned to death if they ran away. But they were also sometimes allowed to buy their freedom. Trade and commerce, not a lot of trade. Salt, metals, cheese, fish, jewels. And by the end of this period, and slaves, and by the end of this period, 1066 is the end of my period today. Norwich had, just to give you an example, the big towns, Norwich, 6,600 people and 20 churches. Lincoln, 6,000 people and 12 churches. That was the kind of thing. Much of the law was never written down. They still used magical trials. We don't know if she's... Sorry about this. We don't know if she's guilty or not. Well, let's pour very hot water on her arm. And if in 3 days she's okay, it's all healed, this means she's innocent. C'est moyen. Okay, so now we still have... this is a magical trial. We still have elements of that today in Britain. When you go into a court, you put your hand on the Bible. I swear by Almighty God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Now, this idea that if you tell a lie after you've put your hand on the Bible, the idea is like something bad will happen to you. This is not a Christian idea. In the Bible, it doesn't say put your hand on the Bible because it's the Bible. It didn't. Anyway, so there are still occasional magic ideas which survive in today. Holy water in the Catholic tradition. Holy water, lo benit. It's not in the Bible. Jesus never mentioned holy water. It's a complete... and it's an adaptation of the Christian church to magical ideas. We have other magical ideas about wedding rings. Also a fabulous thing, a wedding ring. Not in the Bible. Nothing Christian about a wedding ring. People in my generation can be quite superstitious about wedding rings. For example, because I'm old, I know more people who have died. People are always asked to be buried with their wedding ring, because that's just it's symbolic, but it also comes from magical ideas from the past. The church adapted itself. Now, in theory, the church was against the death penalty. But, you know, there wasn't much they could do about it. Divorce was quite easy. And very slowly, the Christian church made it impossible. In some kingdoms, the position of women was clearly better than several hundred years later. A divorced woman in Kent could keep half of the goods of the family. And rapidly... Oh, there's your Anglo-Saxon church, I told you. And rapidly, more books were being written. This is the Lindisfarne Gospels from the 8th century. Quite sophisticated. And this is the greatest... we don't know who wrote it. This is Beowulf. And Beowulf is an old English heroic epic poem. We don't know who wrote it. And they wrote it sometime in the 9th or 10th century. And in this poem, the hero is attacked by monsters and so on and so forth. It was written in England, but the story happens in Scandinavia. So it's a link to that. This is the film version, which is from later. And this is the Alfred's Jewel, which is one of the very fine, in the British Museum again, one of the very, very fine treasures of King Alfred's time. Now, that's definitely enough for today. You